epic library is huge.
Yeah, my epic library.
I've literally never bought a thing on there.
I don't have one because I knew what would happen. I'd log in to get the free game and I'd never play it. And I have enough games that I paid money for that I'm not playing.
No, you should just do it.
But still, it's just free games, dude. You might as well just decide.
You might as well just get it.
Like, you might as well decide. You know what? Player 2 Pixelcast, episode 43. I am your host, Tim Henderson. I have set my keyboard to Japanese and I can no longer type colons. That means absolutely nothing to anybody. Ken, please say something relevant to somebody. Cool, we've lost Ken. Or maybe we haven't lost Ken. Ken, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. The funny thing is that entire opening bit that you just did sounded
I know. I let's try and pretend like you dropped to not me.
I'm just like, all right, I'll just come in and say, oh, I'm doing great, if I can hear the bit where you start introducing names.
The timing on that was spectacular.
Oh yeah, it was pretty good.
So yes, Ken's here, everyone. Hopefully I still will be. We also have Steve Beck with us today. Cool, and I can no longer hear Steve. This is a great start. Steve, speak again.
Ahoy hoy.
Oh, there we go.
This is the Technical Hitch Podcast, episode 43. I am your host, Anderson. I'm joined by Ken and Steve. And we're not a technical podcast. In fact, we're not going to be talking about video games at all for the second half of the show. We're going to there's a very good chance that it's not. We're going to step back in time to an awkward segment that this show used to have way back when it was on Pixel Hunt. Follow Kenley on Twitter at Pixel Hunt. And we had a section called Other Geekery, and this is effectively that, which is other geeky stuff that we like that isn't video games. I'm probably going to spread that around for about half an hour. But before that, yes, we are actually playing games, and assuming his microphone is now on again, Steve, you've been playing that their remastered Tony Hawk that I hear is a lot better than the last time they tried to remaster Tony Hawk.
It is a lot better than the last time they tried to remaster Tony Hawk because it's it's different. The base game is pretty much like you're playing Tony Hawk's 4, if I'm not mistaken, or at the very least 3 when they added reverts and things like that. My memory of the originals is that the manual was added in 2, but you couldn't revert. So in terms of the tricks you could pull off, it's like some of the later games in the series, but the levels are all the Tony Hawk 1 and 2 levels. The career mode is essentially the same. You're going for the same goals. Collect the skate letters, jump over this gap, collect 5 of these things, find the secret tape, all of that stuff. The original soundtrack's there as well, which is wonderful, bar a few songs that I guess they really couldn't stretch the licenses back to.
Yeah, but turns out,
in general, it's honestly like stepping into a bit of a time capsule. Like, if you did spend any significant amount of time with those games on the PlayStation 1, or in my case, the Dreamcast with Tony Hawk's 2.
In my case, the PC, and I have very weird memories because that is not a good game to play with a keyboard.
It would not be. but yeah, it's a shinier version of what you remember with some cool tweaks. So obviously, a lot of the levels have aged 20 years, much like some of the skaters. So things like the mall are really dilapidated now. It's been abandoned. There's sort of references to COVID and things like that in the school levels. It's really cool. Like, it's just such a good way to do this sort of game.
Wait, did I hear correctly? Did they actually age all the skaters? Are you literally skateboarding around as a bunch of 50-year-olds now?
All of the original lineup have been scanned in at their current age. They do have new skaters. Like, there's the next generation of skaters, so they are all their current age, which is obviously much younger. But yeah, they've sort of upped the ages of all of the original lineups. So they look as they do now.
Hmm. The one story I heard that really pleased me was them renaming a trick.
Yeah, I think the Mute Grab, they renamed that because the inventor of that, I believe he is not a mute. I think he's deaf. And it was sort of like this awkward naming thing that happened. And they reached out to him and asked him if they'd like to, if he would give them an alternate name for it, because obviously it was not named with the best of intentions at the time.
And it's just now that trick is named after the skater who invented that particular
Yeah, I
move.
think so.
Yeah, it's just that skater's name. So it's like, all right, back in the 90s, maybe not the same levels of sensitivities, and it's nice that they've gone back and actually and just yeah, just made something wholesome.
Well, just being able to look clearly, like, all right, the things that haven't aged well that we can do something about,
That's
because,
right.
and the reason why they haven't aged well as well is probably important there.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And I thought that was it. That's actually something that would. It's a very simple thing, like that, like changing a name of a thing. But it's such a meaningful gesture, I feel. And it also sort of speaks of the maturity of the people who made that game, who are looking back on it now. It's like, yes, that was a product of its time. We actually have an opportunity to make something and make amends is not quite the word for it, but we can make things a little bit better.
Well, you can. There are things to revere about that product, but it's not like nothing can ever be improved, and that is one area that could definitely have, and very painlessly, have been changed. Like, it's not.
Absolutely.
One thing I want to. I will probably never buy this. I have never been big enough in skateboarding games, but if I did, I think I could be easily sold on DLC that just leans into the core skaters being like super old. If they have like just like old man injury packs, like if Tony's hip just like kind of fails on him, I would be all over that shit.
I'm going to be really interested if they do Tony Hawk's 3 and 4 as separate entries, or if they do them as sort of expansions to this. I would expect it to be a separate entry, but I think this is probably going to sell well enough for it to be warranted.
Where does the, I guess, like, because Tony Hawk, that franchise ran for quite a long time, because there was
Well, it
one
went
through four.
underground.
It went underground, and then it went on. Was it the Wii?
Oh, they did a bunch of them. There was like Tony Hawk's Underground, Underground 2, American Wasteland, Downhill Jam. Like it did the
And
whole
then
Activision thing where they
they
milked it
had a
to
board, they
death.
had a fill. Yeah, but they also
They
had
ran
like
it
Tony
into the
Hawk's
fucking
Ride.
ground.
Yeah, they had the board, and it's actually just a flat board, and you just sort of like moved your foot next to it, and there's a motion sensor that detected your foot motion.
Oh God, I remember that. Wasn't like
And
Tony Hawk himself like desperately trying to hawk that, saying, "Hey, I'm online if anyone wants to come on and play with me." It's like literally nobody was buying it.
I
So I
imagine
guess my
that
so I
was
guess my
contractual.
question, yeah, because I've like you, Tim, I never got into the Tony Hawk sort of franchise. Where does 1 and 2 sit on the pantheon of Tony Hawk games? Is 1 and 2 like the revered ones, or is it 3, 4, like underground?
I think it depends when you started and what you're looking for. I know some people don't care for those ones as much because they're very arcadey. 2 minute time limit, very small levels compared to later entries in the series. You can't get off your board. There's a lot of what people would say limitations, which at the time I thought was great. Like it was just this really fun game to hang around with a bunch of mates and pass the control around
You
every
could
2 minutes.
say limitation, or, another word, because I feel like something that's annoyed me this last generation and a half even is like just bloat for its own sake at this point. They say limitation, I just kind of hear focus.
Yeah, and I guess that would be, what people would think. Like it's, and it was probably, partially due to the technology and maybe not having as much of a grasp of the PlayStation system as they could with limited memory. You can only load so much of a world in before you have to do loading screens and things. So I'm sure the levels were designed around that as well. Once you got to 3 and 4, which were on the PlayStation 2, they became a lot more open. So open levels, not really time limits as much, But yeah, like a much wider array of things that you could do. And then by the time you got to Tony Hawk's Underground, like full story mode, getting off your board, walking around, being able to get on tops of roofs, like climb up there, set up lines and things like that. And I think it depends when you sort of jumped in and started playing them. So I was playing the demo of Tony Hawk's at friends' houses before the game came out. So I was fully into that. Tony Hawk's 2. I actually missed 3 because I don't think I had a PlayStation 2 at the time, and nor did any of my friends. But one of the first games I got with my PlayStation 2 was Tony Hawk's 4. So that's probably the one that I've spent the most time on out of the whole series, to be honest. So I think it really does depend on what do you want in a skateboarding game. If you're a massive skate fan and you didn't play any of the older Tony Hawk's, you're probably not going to gel with these as much because they are super arcadey. Like, they're not particularly realistic in any way, and as you said, like, what you would see as focus, they would maybe see as limitations. I can't get off my board, I've only got 2 minutes, these objectives are pretty basic.
Were you a big skateboarder, or was it just skateboarding games?
I could skateboard a little bit, but I wasn't okay. Particularly great, but I did really dig skateboarding games.
Right. Because I guess, like, I'm also trying to place this within the sort of, like, the arcadey Tony Hawk 1 and 2 on one spectrum and skate on the other spectrum, which is the super hardcore, like, super, like, high-fidelity skate game.
Skateboarding game. 1 and 2 are the most arcadey of the Tony Hawk's games, so, like, The most realistic skate game would be one end of the spectrum, and Tony Hawk's would be the complete opposite end. Yeah. 1 and 2 at least. And then if you wanted to talk about other skateboarding games, like Thrasher, Skate and Destroy, which is another one I really loved on the PlayStation 1, but was super technical. Like, full-blown hip-hop soundtrack, it was great, but you weren't pulling off 720 or even 900 airs most of the time. It was very ground-based, so your highest points were very technical ground combinations and things like that. And I know a lot of people who really liked Tony Hawk 1 and 2 hated Thrasher.
I would probably hate that. I think I've said numerous times in this podcast, what the fuck happened to the arcade racer?
Ridge Racer? It's gone.
Yeah, there's no Daytona. It's all just Forza and Gran Turismo, and like sometimes slightly more accessible knockoffs.
No. There's still Daytona. Daytona's still there. Daytona's still in the arcade.
It's still there. If you go to an arcade, they still have a friggin' Daytona.
That same machine you played 20 years ago, Tim, it's still there.
It's still there. Like, by this point, how old is Daytona USA? Like
1993, 94?
Yeah, it was the mid-90s, so at least 25 years, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
That was a pretty good game.
That's good.
Remember the days of Ridge Racer launching on every on consoles? Like, that was a launch title?
Ridge Racer launched on the PS1 with one track. Not a whole lot of content. You know, it does have a pretty decent amount of content, though, it turns out, especially since I paid like $10 or something for it. And I say, or something, because I live in Japan and I bought my PlayStation 3 when I was living in London, so my core account for my PlayStation is UK, so Australian currency completely eludes me with this stuff. But Dishonored 2 was like 2 or 3 years old now, was on super deep sale early, mid-August. I think it was like £4 or something, so it was like under $10 Australian, which I guess these days isn't unheard of, but it should be obscene.
I think it's pretty common with some of those Arkane and Bethesda titles. Prey did the same thing. It dropped in price really quickly.
Yeah. And also Dishonored 2 by this point is like a few years old now.
It's maybe actually 3 or 4 years old, but
yeah.
I don't think it did as well as they wanted it to. And I think, because I remember picking that up not long after launch for $20 or $30.
Yeah, it's kind of nuts. It's actually, they had a pretty generous demo when I like jumped into that, and then it's like, you know what? Yes, I am enjoying this enough to give them enough money for 1.5 coffees.
That's Tim's value judgment. How many?
Yeah, that's my value judgment
instead of that item.
And I'm Dishonored 2. Well, I'm in this weird race against time because I'm planning to probably sell off my PS4 Pro in about a month, but I also have no direct intent necessarily to buy a PS4, PS5. or necessarily an Xbox Series. Yeah, Xbox Series, whatever.
So you want to maximize the value you get from the pro sale, but so you're not committed to next gen.
I need to finish this game before I sell it. and it's big. Like, I'm like 15 hours in, and I think I'm like maybe a little bit past halfway, and I'm only playing as one of two characters.
See, the issue with that game is, depending on how you're playing and what difficulty level you're on, it has a huge influence on your playtime of that game. So I think I finished that whole thing in about 20 hours, and I loved every minute of it, but I wasn't playing on a particularly difficult difficulty level. And
I'm on normal, which is not hard.
And I also went loud any time I got caught. You know, some people get so wrapped up in that stealth, oh, I cannot be seen at all. I want to do ghost every mission.
I don't
want to
kill anybody. I'm not too concerned about being perfect with stealth, but I kind of want to get away and then sneak up on them again, as opposed to just slit their throats. But some of the levels in this game are like super creative. Although the one that people I think talked about a lot, which is like the Clockwork Fortress, I actually found it kind of frustrating.
Yeah, I ended up doing the alternate sequence on that level, which means that you don't get to do any of the lever stuff.
Huh. See, I didn't even know about that. Like, they do seem to be like a lot of legitimate ways to approach this. And like, you get to the end of every level and you see all the stuff you missed. And you have to kind of train yourself to think, it's not about getting all of the stuff. What that is a measure of all the different ways you can approach it and all the possible stuff you're going to come across. But I recently just finished a stage, and this is kind of spoilery, but also the game is like, again, 3 or 4 years old at this point. Where, like, you're literally jumping between the past and the present, much like a certain Xbox Series X-S exclusive that seems to be coming out pretty soon.
Also Titanfall 2.
And Titanfall 2, which is freaking awesome. Although, for different reasons, Titanfall 2 was cool because it, like, made cool jumping puzzles and stuff. This, like, meant that my stealth rating went way down, but you could do shit like pop up in front of a guard's view and then, like, transport to another timeline. And then, like, walk effectively through where he would be and then reappear behind him and choke the guy out.
It's interesting that it's been a couple of years and I can't think of any other games that have really done that. And it seems like something that would be ripe for stealing.
Yeah, well, both this and Titanfall 2, I guess, broadly speaking, came out at similar times. Like, they feel this both like quite mid-generation titles, and like that stuff is not really been done again. I've been playing as Emily. I actually don't know like the huge difference between Corvo. I remember reading they had quite different powers though.
Yeah, I think it's their playstyles. Like, I think Corvo is a little less stealth focused. I think he's a little bit better in one-to-one combat. So I played as Emily as well, just because it felt slightly more thematically appropriate, given that you play as Corvo in the first game. So I thought, why not try out Emily? But I think if you finish it once, you can then go back and do like a combination of both of their abilities if you want to.
It's just so much content. This is kind of nuts.
Especially for the price. Like, I'd also played that pretty... I think I played it earlier this year. And the first thing I thought after it was like, oh my god, why does nobody talk more about this game? Because it was like fantastic.
Like, in many ways, it is just more Dishonored, but it is a lot more Dishonored, and it is doing more stuff with the Dishonored formula. Like, there's some really clever levels in this. The visual style and atmosphere feels a little closer to like what it was always trying to be. It looks very nice in the Pro. I expect it probably looks super nice in the 1X.
Here's a question, because Tim, you said I didn't play 2. I've started 1 and probably went 15 minutes in before I stopped. Not because I didn't enjoy it, just at that time when I started, I just didn't have the time to press on, and ever since then it's just been sitting on my pile of shame. Tim, you said you're doing a sort of a non-fatal run.
Well, not exactly non-fatal, just trying not to kill people. I think I've accepted a couple of them. Yeah.
Does the game actually make... Is there a...
There is a chaos difference? Level.
No. Well, no, it's more of a, like, is there any substantial difference between a lethal and non-lethal run? Because like there are some stealth games in which you're non-lethal, like in Deus Ex,
Yes.
Mankind Divided, like they are non-lethal if you shoot them with a
Shot.
trank.
Yeah.
But they're effectively out for the whole, like they make no difference from a corpse.
Yeah, I mean, it's just slightly more difficult to get them with that. The thing is, like, there are quite a number of abilities you can unlock here. And one of them, for Emily at least, is that if you assassinate, like, straight up kill a person, they will just, like, kind of disintegrate into ash. Which, from a stealth perspective, is actually super useful because now you don't have a corpse you have to deal with. Whereas if you're, like, trying to just incapacitate people, then you kind of have to drag the bodies around and, like, so there is the diff, like it is easier, probably in general, to kill.
Okay.
Spend a lot of time putting bodies in dumpsters.
Yeah.
I
But
just
it's
found a corner.
well, I found a corner. It's just that, you know, I've played some stealth games, like I said, like Mankind, Deus Ex, where it's non-lethal, but it actually makes no like tangible gameplay difference. Because if I kill someone, or if I knock them out, like I still have to hide the body somewhere if I don't want to be discovered. So I'm always just
Yeah,
trank,
the main difference between those
like
X games, I
that.
think, is like ammo conservation.
Yeah, I know. That's the only. Then that would be my only concern. It's like, oh, I ran out of tranks. I'll use my silenced pistol now. Like there was no gameplay difference between a lethal and non-lethal run, other than me telling myself I'm doing non-lethal.
Yeah, I think at the like core basic level, this is not a huge one, but I think if you like dig a bit deeper in the way you want to branch out your character development, there are ways to play it advanced. There are definitely ways in which being lethal makes it easier.
Yeah, I think like Hitman does a very good, like if you go for a non-lethal run and you knock someone out and they get found out, like somebody comes and wakes them up.
It's also actually probably worth noting that there's normally a main mark in every level. Like there's a norm, like, okay, this is the crazy person who owns this mansion and you need to do something about them or whatever. And there will normally be a more creative, non-lethal way to deal with a problem that is very heavily scripted, but you'd have to kind of find and track down clues for.
Yeah, the
And
easier
that can
thing would
affect the
just be to
story.
leap in there and stab them, but there's usually something much more exciting to do from a narrative perspective, but it can be a bit trickier gameplay-wise. And then there's the chaos system, which sort of layers onto everything, so it's tracking how much chaos you're causing, which then results in I know in
Rats.
Dishonored 1 like a higher
First one is
level of
rats.
rats and just more guards in general in later levels. So if you're playing lethally, they do that to cater to that. So obviously you want to kill lots of people, we're going to give you more people to kill.
Well, the other perspective would be you took the easy way out and now it's become harder later on.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely so I'm like soaking up the atmosphere. I actually just really like being in this world. I think that just a little bit of difference in the generational power leap has done quite a lot in terms of the like kind of fleshing out the atmosphere.
I've just installed Death of the Outsider on my PS4 Pro to play through that as well.
I played that a while ago and that for whatever reason didn't super gel with me. It could have been timing, but I definitely after this I think I want to give it another look.
I think it's also a different character with an extremely different
It
power
is.
set. I think from what I've read, they were doing some pretty heavy experimentation with Death of the Outsider, and there was
Yeah,
even a few
I
powers
think
they sidelined because they just couldn't get them to work.
from memory, I think the abilities just didn't click with me. Which is important, like, I feel like Blink in particular, like, that kind of made something to me. The fact that you could kind of, like, just zip around like an anime ninja, like, literally just basically teleport around the stage, is kind of like a game changer. But whatever. I mean, it's actually. I'm like super happy. It's a super good game, and like it's frequently available cheap. And I would not hesitate to tell anybody if like that atmosphere in particular, like if the look of it looks appealing, give it a shot. And apparently, I'm guessing the PC version probably has it as well. There is a generous ass demo that's like a good 4 hours long, I think.
I don't know if that was out on launch. I wonder if that was in sort of in service of trying to
I
increase sales
feel
as
like
well.
they did that. I think Bethesda did that with a few other games a year or two after.
Oh, okay.
After the
But when
fact.
they were not giving press anything, wonder if that was part of
Possibly.
that.
Very possibly. Anyway, you know what you don't have to pay for at all? Ken, tell me about my biggest disappointment of this year slash kind of last year in a weird roundabout way.
I've said before in previous episodes that I really haven't been having much time to play new games or any games really. So in an effort to at least have something to say, I downloaded Sky onto my phone and played it for all of less than 5 minutes, less than 10 minutes.
This is such a mobile phone judgment period, by the way.
Yeah, it is absolutely. Like, I downloaded it today. Just I'm like, oh no, I'm going to be on the Pixelcast. I need to say something. I can't be like, let's talk about Ghost of Tsushima again.
Oh, could you?
I mean, I could, but let's not. And I need something to say. And let's. Oh, I saw an ad. I literally saw an ad from it on YouTube, saying that game company Sky. I'm like, oh. I like that game company. I like Flower. I like Journey. Sky's that game. That sounds great. I think people have talked about it before. Let's give it a shot. I've played all of 10 minutes, just the opening bit, and it's very Journey, but it's also...
It's like Journey with the soul completely sucked out of it.
It's Journey with a skill tree.
And microtransactions, if you get a bit deeper.
Everything about it is just... Everything that I've seen so far is just... I remember that you like Journey.
Journey is hands down my favorite game of last generation.
And this is everything, you know, like, let me remind you how much this is like Journey. You are sliding around like Journey. You are floating around like Journey. But wait, you can level up. And
there's a whole lot of meandering around, and the social aspect feels a lot more forced.
It's just like I'm looking at it, but you're right. There isn't a lot of. I mean, there's some interesting things about it. Like the opening sequence was interesting. I'm hoping. I'm kind of like intrigued by the narrative. I think part of why Journey was so compelling is you don't know anything about the world. And there are hints and suggestions of what the world might have been, but it doesn't bother telling you anything about this world.
I was going to say it doesn't bother. I think it intentially keeps us close.
That's true.
Our cards very close to the chest, which I think is right up my alley, to be fair.
I think that is more accurate description. And this one has like some hints of that, but it opens up with a story and like with subtitles telling you about the stars that fell down. And this is not spoiler territory. This literally happens.
This is the opening moments.
Like, yeah, the opening moments. And it's like, oh, the light has disappeared and now you must go gather the stars. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, there's a level of mystique that's been removed.
It just feels like they've gone and tried to committee fight or I don't know. It's so much of what made Journey wonderful is missing from the game and it was such a bummer. And I had such a weird time trying to get to play it. So when I visited Australia over Christmas, remember when like just gigantic bushfires was the biggest problem we had to deal with?
I can't believe there was only summer that you were here, Tim. Like it was only.
It feels like yesterday and 10 years ago at the same time.
Yeah.
But I had pre-registered interest in that game, obviously. And then I like actually managed to download it for the flight. But then, like, it didn't quite download fully, and then I was able to download the rest when I got to Australia, but then the sound wasn't all there, and it's like, we need to download the rest of this audio back, and I was like, cool. And then I just got stuck on an endless loop and would not start anymore. So I had to actually delete it, and then it took a few more months again before I was actually able to download the game again, even. And then the game turned out to be... Yeah. Sigh.
How much have you actually played?
I've probably played 30, 40 minutes...
Okay.
Which isn't a lot, but keep in mind, 30-40 minutes is, in Journey time, significant and enough to have your breath, like, fully stolen away.
Yeah. I mean, there are a few things. Like, if you click on the character, they'll give you a marker to show you where you need to go. I'm like, really? Okay. Like,
see, Journey didn't even need that because it was so well-directed. Like, you just kind of flowed into the...
Yeah, like in Journey, you kind of, you went where you thought you would naturally go, but the game's actually directed you there. Very subtly and
it's
using...
completely linear, but you never notice.
That's right. But here it's like, oh, I'm lost. Oh, there's the thing I need to go to. Click on my character and it will give me a map marker. I'm like, ooh, map marker. That's like, that's your number one transgression there, map marker.
I don't know if they forgot how to do this or if it was just in terms of trying to make it a free-to-play mobile game, like everything they had to do to like flesh it out just kind of killed the soul of what that game should have been.
I mean, part of it, I mean, I would anticipate that. I mean, we're really shitting on this game right now. And Steven...
There are much worse mobile games. I should point that out, but...
Yeah, yeah. Feel free to jump in on this anytime you want, Steve.
Oh, I gave it a go, and I had some massive issues even getting the thing to run because...
Yeah, I had that too, remember?
Very, very early on, they had... It required Game Center, but at no point did it tell you that it required Game Center, and I didn't use Game Center on my iPhone. So it would boot up, and then it would just lock up. And I actually emailed them for support to be like, hey, is this a bug? Like, what's going on? And they couldn't tell me. And then I gave Game Center a try. I was like, oh, I wonder if it's something to do with this. And that sorted it out. And by that point, I'd kind of lost interest anyway.
Yeah. You play the game and like I said, like you get lost because you don't know where to go. And you don't know where to go because it's just not that well signed, like non-verbal. And you kind of need the, oh, click on this character, click on your main character and it'll give you a map marker. Imagine playing Journey with a map marker.
No.
It's just, and part of that problem is because they're working this on a mobile screen. It's really hard to see. It's tiny.
It's...
Right? Like, yeah. And the visual...
Maybe as a tablet game it could have... this game seemed like it was announced years ago.
Yeah.
Maybe at that time, like, even Android tablets still seemed like a viable thing, and I don't know what the vision was.
Possibly. Maybe. Like it's really hard to sort of navigate, and then I haven't been doing the social stuff yet. But it does feel like, and you click on the thing and yeah, a skill tree comes out, and you're
the
like
social stuff. The way it just feels so forced. The thing about like Journey had the most organic, delightful, surprising social element of any game in existence.
I think this has now become like less of a shit on Sky and more of like reminisce about how.
Let's just talk about the Journey is really fucking good. If you have not played Journey, it is on everything now. Well, actually, that's a lie, but it's on, like, PC and all the PlayStations.
Yeah, all the PlayStations.
It's on Epic and Steam, I think, and it's probably pretty friggin' cheap.
Do you think they could rework Sky onto Switch? Is that something that would be viable? But would it require a massive overhaul?
I mean, I have fundamental design issues with this. I mean, I think a lot of them became... as trying to make it as a mobile game, but they'd have to reverse engineer so much stuff, they may as well almost make a new game.
Yeah, I think so. It's just, like, I think my biggest problem so far with it, I'll probably give it another go later, but my biggest problem with it is just, it's very much banking on the, I know you like Journey, so here's the next one, as opposed to this is something completely new and you've never seen before.
Journey was, you instinctively understood this is from the people who made Flower, but it was not the next Flower.
That's right. It was not the next Flower. Like you can understand and appreciate the sensibilities, the similar sensibilities, but it was completely different. And this is very much like,
hey, remember that Journey thing? You like that, huh? Please.
Yeah. You like that thing. But this is bigger and better. This is the Call of Duty version of Journey.
All right, I think I'm just going to call a music break there. I don't want to talk about this anymore. when we're going to come back, we're going to talk about absolutely stuff that we like. I got your flowers. Let's get some coffee. Look deep in my eyes and tell me.
Martinez.
more traditional, go for a walk, watch a movie. Actually, there's a really nice flower exhibit at the Botanical Gardens. Ninja Brian was just telling me about that last week. He loved it. Wait, you know what? Fuck it!
Let's kill some guy tonight! We're holding hands and laughing while we shank him in the starlight! Let's take a motherfucking life tonight! We're young and alive! Wish I could save for that guy!
And we're back! And in a very brief off-air discussion, we have discovered that Steve is now super into board games, and Ken has promised that maybe he's not going to talk about board games entirely, but he still wants to start with talking about Steve's board games. So Steve, we are talking about not video games, just as a weird off-kilter thing for this one particular episode. Why should I care about the board games that go beyond Monopoly?
I started playing a lot more board games just to kind of get away from video games. I was starting to feel really burnt out with a lot of video games. And I'd had a couple of board games sitting in the cupboard, and I thought it was time to sort of start breaking them out. And then I fell down a complete rabbit hole of rapidly going through what would be considered gateway games, and ended up selling a whole bunch of them that I didn't even open because I progressed so rapidly to much heavier, more complex games. Now to the point where I have a 1.5 meter by 1 meter custom neoprene mat on my board gaming table for those extra nice dice rolls, and the cards go slidey around on there, and it's very good.
See, I don't even know what that is. All I know is it translates to fancy board game table to me.
So like, it's like a mouse mat, like, but it's as big as my entire table.
All right.
It's
the body's your house.
Yes, it's good. I think just the tactile nature of it, and like having a table where I can just leave, especially very lengthy games set up. So I'd always wanted to get into more board games, and I could not convince my wife to get in on anything that was above a certain weight level or complexity level. She was just not interested. And then I discovered that some of the games I had in the cupboard, you could actually play solo. They have solo modes where you can play through, and some of them even have campaigns where, not necessarily a story, but you have to play with set conditions through each game. And yeah, I just, again, it progressed really rapidly, and now I know a bunch of different board game designers whose work I really enjoy, and I'm following what they're doing and things like that. And it's really weird to develop a hobby like this when you're older and have money.
Yeah, I want you to talk me through the board game by yourself, because I'm sure this is actually legit. But I know that if I was filming a TV show episode or something, and I wanted to like just show that a person is just kind of just really sad, having like a bit of stock footage of them playing a board game by themselves would be a great shorthand.
Oh, and I'm sure it would. And no, don't worry. I get that quite a lot. My wife put a photo up of me with my mat where I didn't realize she was taking a photo, so I look like a complete doofus anyway. But I got ragged on that quite a bit. People making fun of my mat and me being a Nigel No Friends. No one will play board
games.
Whatever,
man, is something that there are two things that you've learned, everybody's learned during COVID, which is one, you want to get out more, but also that you need more time alone. If you do not live alone, it can be super hard to have alone time, and it turns out that is also super important. So sure, be a Nigel No Friends, if that's what you want to call it.
Well, I think I just realized that I'd wanted to play more board games, but no one would play with me. So it got to the only barrier being I didn't have anyone else to play with, so I just shifted lanes to games that you don't need anyone else to play with if you don't want to. Everything I have, if I can rope in another person or two to play, then cool, it'll be a different experience. But I was like, well, I want to play these things, and if I can't rope anybody else in, then I'll just continue on anyway. It does mean that there's a bunch of like games that are widely acclaimed that I can't really justify picking up because I don't know if I'll be able to get someone else on board to play with me. Yep. But yeah, it's I like just sort of sitting in my study at night with the sort of the tactility of it, moving little pieces around a board and thinking about strategies and, you know, planning out moves and all those sorts of things. It's like a real change of pace from video games, where I felt like I was just in this weird pattern where it was just thoughtless. It was just like something I did to pass time, but I wasn't really invested in it. I think I've played enough video games at the point where I'm just on autopilot.
I feel like I need to wade in now.
It had to happen.
Wait ahead.
It had to happen. Wait, I'm going to wade in because I've been a big board game fan for a very long time. It's really only in the last 4 to 5 years which I've really dropped off. And that's mostly because it's hard to get to board game sessions and gaming groups and that sort of thing.
Mm.
And it is hard to keep pace after a while.
Dude, it's hard to keep pace in a day. I think, was it 2014, 2015, I visited you and you took me to a mill. And every time I would get into a game at this event you took me to, everybody would immediately move on to a completely different game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
By the time I'd learned the rules and settled in, it was like, okay, I'm enjoying this next game.
That is absolutely one criticism I have of the hobby with some of the communities, is that it's all about the new hotness. And what I'm finding the sweet spot to be is games that are about 4 to 5 years old.
No, no, this wasn't it. I dragged Tim. I purposely organized a full day gaming session with a whole heap of people, including Nathan Cox and Paul Houlihan from, he was previously from THQ, and a whole bunch of other people, Stacy, like a whole bunch of like Victorian gamers that we see on the Twitters, right?
Yeah.
And I purposefully organized a whole gaming session, and I dragged Tim to it, and he had to, like, well, this was, well, he had to play board games for the entire day. From morning, we started like 10 in the morning, and we finished at like 6 or 7 at night. And this was in the city. And there's a few things that I wanted to weigh in, because, like, there's a very big difference between board gaming and video gaming, but at the same time, not that many differences as well. Like, playing a solo board game is not that different than playing a single player game, like on your PC. Because very often those board games have some type of pre-programmed AI into it, because there are steps.
I could easily see dice throws just being...
No, there are various other systems. Like, you have to draw X number of cards, and you have to do out specific actions for the opponent. So there are things in which they there are board games where they generate their own AI with the rules. So that's, you know, it's not that different playing a single player campaign game if you were to play a single player board game. So
I do think it is hugely just an image thing. So board games are just, absolutely, at least broadly speaking, are like always like advertised to the masses as like family fun, or have your friends around for an evening of mystery and whatever. It's like how movies, like the idea of going to the cinema by yourself seems stupid until you actually go to the cinema by yourself and realize it's kind of awesome.
It's amazing.
Right. It's all so good.
With that analogy, it would be like those family games and Monopoly and things like that are like the Disney films of the board gaming world. But I guess, like you've alluded to, for a lot of people, those are the only board games that exist. So when you look at this like wide scope of all of these other types of games that exist, it's kind of a little bit mind-boggling.
Yeah. What I would say is maybe important here, as the person who was forcefully dragged in
for a day, you enjoy yourself. Come on,
I did more or less, but I still would have preferred it if we just stuck to one or two games for that day. Because, like, literally by the time I'd learned how something worked, we were moving on to the next thing. I seem to recall a gem-based card game I liked and a castle building game that I liked, but like trying to define I guess what you call like the bridge games, like the one that has definitely more depth than like this is a random like the roll of the dice and buy other property, which is basically how you play Monopoly, but that isn't so in depth that you're just gonna scare the shit out of anybody who you like propose to play it with.
Oh, there are absolutely games like that. Absolutely.
Do you want to like run down a few, like just maybe two or three?
If I had to, like, my history is a little bit old now. So Steve might have a few newer, more recent examples. Reiner Knizia's Samurai is a very good game of that sort, where the rules are very basic, but the strategy unfolds in a very in a way that it's quite crunchy is the way I think a lot of board gamers describe. It's got a lot of crunch to it. It's a bit of a brain burner. You spend a lot of time contemplating and thinking about the potential possibilities, but the rule set is actually very simple. You just place a tile, and the numbers are not big. It's between 1 and 3. You're right, but the possibility space is quite big. There's another game. So that's one I always go to as a good introduction to concepts which are different from Monopoly and Snakes and Ladders and that sort of thing. Carcassonne is always a good another good game to introduce mechanics. Yeah. Not just as a game of on its own. As a game on its own, it's all right.
There's a few sort of standard answers that float around on this topic. And these days it's things like Catan and Ticket to Ride and a few other games that are sort of, they're classified as gateway games, which I think the idea is that it is the game that will get your friends away from Monopoly and start them on their journey to the heavier games that you actually want them to play with you. But you know, if you roll that board out, they're going to look at it and run in the opposite direction. So I think that's what you're getting at, Tim, like the idea of a bridge, like a game that will take you from Monopoly and Uno and stuff like that to suddenly you've got 40 cards in front of you, so, and 17 minifigs.
Yeah.
And
actually, I
thought, well, either a gateway or something around that would just be, because I hate Monopoly.
It's
like a lot of the family. I got sent the Nintendo one for Christmas. Actually, it's a bit better than the normal one. I can tolerate it. But I think a lot of the family board games are just boring random dice rolls with not a whole lot going on.
Oh, absolutely. I was going to say a really old favorite of mine, which I've used quite successfully to teach people like the different concepts of board games, is Power Grid. Have you played Power Grid, Steven? Oh, Steven's a bit
Steve
busy.
Apparently has a kid, so you can ask me if I've played Power Grid, and
you have not played Power Grid. I'll ask him when he comes back. Maybe we should go to you. And let Steve come back.
Yeah, let's just take a hard segue. Are we going to talk about me about board games or what I'm going to talk about? No, I came up with this topic. This is like the biggest cop out topic of all time. About a month ago, and it's ironic that I think the thing I wanted to talk about the most was back when Huso had just reviewed a little thing that Sennheiser had sent him for his like PC audio, and he was like, "Oh my gosh, this is amazing! It's like changing my speakers forever." And that's just, and Ken, I actually know you don't care too much about this stuff, and I think it's easy not to and perfectly happy not to, but I feel like with a lot of like gaming PCs, you kind of spend a lot of money on, you get a nice monitor, then you get a nice graphics card, and like everything's sweet. But everybody just kind of plugs everything into the onboard audio. Like in the speakers, and the way I see it is it's kind of like you've got the speakers and they're the equivalent of the monitor, but you don't have the audio version of the graphics card. And sometimes it sounds kind of shit. And the reason I'm saying this is kind of ironic is as of Friday, I basically had an ENT tell me I have tinnitus for life, which fucking sucks.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how does that play out? Like, are you hearing, like, things?
I just have a high-pitched scream in my right ear that is never going to go away.
No, that's not good.
No, and ironically, this is a year where I've not really listened to anything on a very loud volume, so it was probably triggered by stress. So thanks, COVID. So it is weird that I kind of wanted to like talk about like the overlooked thing is like it is unbelievable how much of a difference spending a couple of $100 just to buy a like little USB chip effectively can actually transform, particularly like I guess your home will depend, like your TV will be soundbar or whatever. But it is crazy the difference that is actually made. And I guess it's just like really, like it's very easy to sell a graphics card. It's like, look what this graphics card do. We can put a video up on YouTube and you can kind of appreciate it. It's very hard to sell audio that way. In the same way, I guess it's hard to sell VR if you don't have it.
Yeah. But I think you can imagine VR. Like, it's very hard to imagine audio. Like, you're right in that I don't really care. But, I mean, but there's also a very good chance that I don't care because I've never listened, I've never actually tried to put effort into it. And if I did try, and maybe I would have the same life-changing experience that Yuzo had.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing that stood out there was, like, you bought these really expensive Bose speakers, and while Bose is kind of like a premium, maybe slightly overpriced what you get brand, the thing that he noted was, like, they weren't, he was always saying he was kind of disappointed by them. And it was the same for me with my current speakers, which are not quite that expensive. And I think it's a lot of people, like, now these days, like, kind of high-end headphones are kind of trendy, but people are just plugging them into their phones.
Mm.
And you're like, you were missing the key bit. It's like kind of garbage in, garbage out. Like, this will sound better than what came packaged back when phones came packaged with earbuds.
Yeah. I do have a few friends who claim to be audiophiles. And one of my biggest, I guess, my biggest, one of the things I found hardest to understand about audio is that, how do I say this? Like, it's more complex than video.
It is, and it's also harder to articulate at the same time.
It's harder to articulate. It's harder to find that balance. Like, I've got friends who claim to be audiophiles who then say, you know, this is the X thing. You got to have it on these settings. And all I hear is loud.
Yeah, that...
So that's...
I've started... I mean, there's this idea... Because the more expensive speakers and headphones you get, the more power they basically require to work properly a lot of the time. That's not exactly how it works, but generally the more premium stuff requires more electricity to really function.
Right.
What I sort of think is, like, there's a difference between loudness and volume.
Mm-hmm. So,
and loudness I think of as, like, a shower that's just going to, like, blast you across the room, and volume is kind of like a bath that will, like, just gradually immerse you. And you want more volume, but you don't necessarily want to blast loudness too high.
Yeah. And I have, like, I can sort of, like, this is very loud, but I don't necessarily hear it clearer, or I don't necessarily hear the notes.
This sounds like they... You've plugged a pair of $700 headphones into just your PC's out jack without having anything in between.
Oh no, it's just more of like, you know, they've got their whole audio setup, and they've got their vacuum tube, whatever things, and either they don't know what they're talking about, which
maybe
is
the damage
likely.
Of the hearing. It is. I mean, it's very easy to get caught up in just trends and buzzes and
And I think, like, treble, bass, something, and you have to have the concert setting for the thing, and you can only listen to this type of music, but if you're listening to that type of music, you have to have this type of setting.
Well, one thing that's been reinforced by my recent shitty situation is that, like, hearing is actually very subjective to a degree. So when I kind of went in and, like, had my ears examined and, like, did the hearing test and whatever, the graph came back showing me as, like, slightly better at hearing bass than average. But my treble reception was way down, and that's what's causing the ringing, is my brain is trying to compensate for it. And years, I've, like, kind of had this vendetta against, and I think Beats really started it, like, these really bass-heavy headphones that has kind of been trendy for, like, the last decade. And I've always leaned more towards treble-heavy stuff, and it could very well turn out to be that my treble hearing has always been kind of weak.
Hmm.
And so that bends me in that direction. But of course that is not going to work to somebody who maybe hears bass on a normal level and hasn't damaged their treble receptor.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, so I don't really care about audio, but that's also very likely because I haven't actually experienced it properly.
Yeah, next time in Australia, I'll bring... Cause the one thing I find, a lot of, like, the really flash stuff is more, like, fancy, like, up-to-date Bluetooth and whatever. What I've kind of learned is the best stuff you can get if you want stuff that sounds really good is to buy top-of-the-line that's 5 years old.
Yeah.
And it will still sound so much better than, like, the newest release stuff that's 500. I mean, I have a dedicated player that's probably worth about, that cost me about what would work at about $500 Australian. But it was released in 2014 or what would have been about upwards of $2,000 Australian.
Yeah.
It is not worth $2,000, but it is worth $5,000.
Yeah, well, Steven's back.
Yes.
Hey, Steve, you should buy a DAC for your PC. I'm just going to wrap up what I kind of want to get at here, which is I feel like people maybe spend a lot of money on the speakers expecting miracles, and you might want to split that budget between. The most common would be like a Dragonfly. But if you've got like $600 to spend on speakers, spend $200 powering them. Then buy the speakers. And the one last thing you should do is go into your sound settings and, for the love of God, just use the cheapest microphone you have and just room calibrate it, and you'll actually get a decent sensor audio. Like simulation, assuming you're using stereo, which I'm assuming 90-something percent of PC people probably are. Anyway, now that we've got our weirdly structured hard segue, Steve, what is your ideal Monopoly replacement for the family game cupboard?
I guess like Ken would probably be able to mirror this, but it depends what you want. Once you get outside of just like that Monopoly sort of game style, there are so many different types of board games built around different mechanics, and what you'll find is that there are mechanics that you absolutely love and mechanics that you hate. So there will be whole games that you can just write off, not based on what they're about, but just, I don't like to do that particular thing in a game. So for Monopoly, I've actually replaced Monopoly with the Monopoly Deal card game, because the thing I hate about Monopoly is it runs for way too long for how enjoyable the game it is. So Monopoly Deal is a $10 card-based version of Monopoly.
Becomes like old bubblegum by the end.
Yeah, this game you can knock out in 15 minutes.
Monopoly Deal is genuinely actually fun to play.
Yeah, it's still got this screw-you-over aspect that Monopoly has, but it's over in 15 minutes. It's not this protracted experience where you have to suffer a slow death from late-stage capitalism.
Yeah.
Having said that, Monopoly is actually very good at what it was intended for before it became a fun-for-all-the-family game, which is actually proving that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before you had to go check in on your kid, Stephen, I was going to say that Power Grid has actually been a really good like gateway game for me.
Yeah, that's always like, mentioned as like one of the classics of that style as well.
It's like a really, really heavy game. It's a really heavy game that has enough elements to it where you can be like, oh, I kind of understand. Like one of the biggest challenges with board games is there's sometimes some of them have very abstract mechanics and very abstract sort of. It's very abstracted from the theme. So
yeah,
you're not quite exactly sure.
What you're doing doesn't make sense for what the theme is. Yeah, so if the mechanics line up with the theme, it makes sense. And even like a non-board gamer can sit there and go, oh, well, yeah, that's a thing that you would actually do in this thing, so it makes sense. But when the mechanics are very separate from the theme, I think it makes it so much more difficult to explain to someone why they're doing what they're doing.
And Power Grid, I found, is a fairly abstract game in terms of its mechanics, but the theme matches up. You can use the theme to explain the mechanics very well. Like, in Power Grid, you own power companies. You own power stations.
Right. Makes sense. Right?
You can build a variety of power stations. Coal, nuclear, wind, right?
Cool, so you can destroy the planet or save the planet. I like this.
Yeah. There is a marketplace for you to buy fuel. You don't need to buy fuel if you've got a wind farm. Makes sense. Like, you don't need to participate in the auction of fuel if you have a wind farm. But if you've invested in a gas station or a coal station, you'll need to go to the market and auction and bid for fuel. And using the fuel, you then feed it into your power station, and your power station powers the city to which it's connected to, and you earn money from that. That's the entire game. That's Power Grid. And from there, you're like, okay, there's an auction. I need to buy this stuff for that stuff. I need to use the stuff here for another stuff. That there is a logic chain, and that actually makes it really easy for people to understand. Like, it can get really cutthroat. The auctions can get really cutthroat. There is quite a lot of thinking. It's a very crunchy game. There's quite a lot of like pre-planning and calculating. It's like, okay, if I spend $10 on this, do I have left enough money to spend $15 on this other thing? There's a lot of math going on. But the logic chain is there. You understand where you're at at each step. Now, that's why it's actually a really good gateway game, even though it's actually quite heavy. It's one of my favorite ones. But that's another game, though.
I guess, like, something that would be very easy to sell. Like, there any, I'm assuming there have to be board games that are being built around people's favorite TV shows and whatever. Any of those ever actually... So, like, I know Game of Thrones beers that were actually brewed by, I think, Omega Gang, so they had a decent brewery behind it, and then they just kind of played a little bit safe with the style.
Yeah, the Game of Thrones board game is very good. I actually got Dylan Burns to play it.
I've got that in the cupboard with all the expansions. It's quite good if you can get at least three people around for 5 to 6 hours.
Yeah, it's a good four-player game. It's very good. The Doom board game is actually really good. Yeah, the Doom board game is legitimate.
Doom seems like the most unboard game-like game imaginable.
Yeah, it kind of, you would think so. The Gears of War board game is actually not bad as well.
But that one I can imagine.
The Doom board game is actually pretty good. But it's mostly like you and like friends teaming up to kill like hordes of enemies. There's a couple others, but yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to have to segue this, Ken. You promised me this wasn't all going to be board games, as if you had something else up your sleeve.
More board games.
Oh, I mean, I think if you follow my Twitter,
I guess it'd be Gundam, which you discovered recently, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was going to say Gundam.
All right, I'm sure.
Like I've discovered recently Gundam, and if you've been following my Twitter over the last couple of years, you know that Archery has been a big part of that as well. Mm. But I won't talk about Archery. There's nothing much to talk about Archery. It's like you put a stick on a string and then you shoot it. That's fun. it's fairly easy to explain. And this actually ties into a few different things. I recently started, I like to binge things on Netflix. So, a couple of Gundam series appeared on Netflix. I'm like, okay, you know, I've got some hours to kill. Why not? The first one I seen was, it's all right. Nothing super. The second one I watched was really, really got to me. Just got in deep, that's nails deep into me. That's Iron-Blooded Orphans. And then I started playing a tabletop RPG with some friends. Aaron online, friend of the show. He used to have a podcast called Action Points. And he does a whole bunch of stuff. Like he designs his own board games as well, and does a whole bunch of other things. And he started running a tabletop RPG that we play over Discord and using Roll20, the website, which I still don't know how to fully use, but it allows you to roll dice and put maps up and put characters and character sheets and that sort of thing. So we use Roll20, we use Discord, and we've been playing over the internet with five. There's five of us in the game. We play. We're using the game that we're playing is Beam Saber. Beam Saber is a Gundam inspired RPG.
And there's so I feel like I spaced out for a few seconds and was like, how are we back to board games again?
No, so this is
it's board all games connected.
Board games are not RPGs. Let's get that straight. They're two completely different things. Doesn't matter. So I've been playing this tabletop RPG with some friends, which is inspired by Gundam and Mecha and anything. So I've got my character, I've got my character sheets, I've got my mech. And we're playing like every week or every other week, and this has been sort of my thing to do during this COVID lockdown. It's been one of the highlights over this COVID lockdown, that is slightly different, out of the norm, things I normally wouldn't do. I really dropped off board games in the last 5 or 6 years because it's hard to get to a gaming session. that applies for tabletop RPGs. It's hard to get to a session with friends, physically sit around a table for half a day and do that. So the fact that I've been able to do this at home, over the internet, at night after the kids have gone to bed, great. And I've been doing it every week for the last 5 or 6 weeks. Actually more than that, like the last like 3 months. And over this period of time, because as we're playing this tabletop RPG, I'm like, okay, I would like to get some more inspiration about how to play this game and the setting and that sort of thing, some of the common themes. I've just been smashing like Gundam. I think I tweeted last week all the shows I've seen. Gundam 00, Gundam UC, Iron Blood Orphan, Seed, Seed Destiny, Build Fighters, and a couple others. I've also started buying, I bought myself a Gunpla, like the plastic models, so I can build over the school holidays that's coming up soon.
Oh, you are in deep.
Oh, yeah. I've been looking at paints. I am so deep, I'm looking at paints. And like, And I literally was asking, another friend of the show, Nathan Cox.
I was about to say, Nathan would be proud.
I'm like, Nathan, like, what can you tell me about, like, acrylic paints and
that's
airbrushes?
Definitely a next step I'm not ready for yet.
So I have been deep, and I think it surprised me. I think it surprised me as much as anybody else, because I did not expect... Like, I've always been aware of Gundam, and I know that there's all these plastic sets, and I know that... I actually don't know how big it actually is in Japan. Is it actually huge in Japan, Tim?
It's entrenched, but I don't think it's as big as some people like to imagine it is.
Yeah, like
it's sort of like...
What is big is One Piece, and One Piece is bigger than the rest of anime put together.
I was going to say, like, it doesn't feel like it's, like, the huge thing, but it's, like, constantly there. It's been there since the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's entrenched. Entrenched is the word I'm going to go for. Like, it will always be there. It will probably never be the biggest thing again, but it will always be Gundam.
Yeah. I think, and like Tim's alluded, I think it's probably just hasn't caught on with the younger generations as much. So anytime I've been in Japan, there's heaps of Gundam stuff everywhere, but it's definitely not the most popular thing going at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know, and I've been aware of this franchise, and I know that they've got the big mecha, which I also like. You know, mecha appeals to me as well, but I've never been a Gundam person. I've been more of a Macross Robotech person.
Do you think that, like, part of the reason is that it does seem to be sort of this, like, omnipresent or granddaddy kind of thing of the genre, so maybe it gets a little bit taken for granted, or things that have taken from it, you know, like, it's sort of like I never played Half-Life 1 or 2, and then I played Bioshock and was like, oh my god, this game is amazing, and people are like, oh, other games have done that sort of stuff before, you just never played them, so you never had the cultural touchstone or reference point for it. So do you think that having consumed mecha stuff that came in the wake of Gundam meant that Gundam was less appealing to you?
No, I think I've always misunderstood Gundam as being a kiddie thing. Like, it's like for kids, whilst Macross was the grown-up stuff.
Yeah, they both have quite a bit of politicking going on.
I had not realized it. Like, I honestly did not appreciate that Gundam had that much, like, straight up, like, politics and war. And it's not a very much. It's not the most nuanced breakdown of war. And you know, it's fairly simplistic and naive. But they don't shy away from death, and they don't shy away from showing broken people.
I think in some ways I feel like it's still maybe not aimed at the youngest of young kids, but it feels like a junior high level, and it's just more that they're willing to trust that audience with those themes a bit more.
Yeah, and they haven't shied away from showing people who are fundamentally like broken by the after effects of war and conflict and people struggling. And I think there's quite a lot of like struggling with emotions, struggling with personal growth, trying to break through and failing. There's a lot of failure in Gundam. There's a lot of like letting your friends down and not being as strong as you think you are and being and thinking you're a disappointment. There's a lot of that stuff, and I'm like looking at this, I'm like, I did not appreciate that Gundam was like this. Like I said, it's not like a nuanced, you know, treatise about the military industrial complex or like late stage capitalism, but like the characters are struggling and they're visibly struggling on screen, and they're often very young, and they are coming to grips with themselves and their place in the world. I'm like, oh, I don't think I've ever appreciated Gundam from that lens. And I wonder if I'm appreciating it more now, being as old as I am. Like, if I were a kid, I remember my peers when we were sort of in our mid to late teens, and my friends being super crazy about Gundam Wing. And everything was just because it's cool and robots and like that one mecha with the giant scythe, right? And the one with the giant guns. If I were to go back now, I think I'll probably pick up different themes and probably a little bit more under the surface than I would have then.
Oh, like almost certainly. In fact, I think it's kind of, I feel like a lot of the stuff you're saying may actually apply to, like, not definitely not all. Definitely not all, but perhaps more anime than a lot of people realize. I think part of the problem the West has at the moment, if you see an anime avatar on Twitter, that is a red flag above all red flags.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I was gonna say, Ken, it sounds, I think I had a similar experience with Evangelion, because at the age that I was watching it, I definitely was not getting a lot of the subtext that is in that show. I was just like,
cool. That show is bonkers.
Cool show with robots is cool. And then watching it as a much older person, I'm like, whoa.
That show deals with some shit.
Anno had a lot of stuff going on. Like, a lot of stuff.
Like, Evangelion is a great example, because I remember in my, I would have been in my mid to late teens when Evangelion came out. It's like 94, 95, 96?
96, 97, I think.
It in Australia, it broadcast on SBS in 1999.
Yeah, so I remember, giant robots, crazy monsters, and also, like, really cute girls, like, really cute anime girls, right? Like,
but
that's
also,
all I remember.
It's also like focused on abandonment issues and PTSD and some very confused sexual energy.
Yeah, but see, I wouldn't have gotten that. Like the scenes in which what's the main character's name? Shin?
Right, Shinji Ikari.
Shinji. Like his scenes with Rei and even his scenes with the other Asuka.
And then Misato.
I would have probably just read that as sort of like hee-hee-hee, titty stuff.
Yeah.
See, the first episode he went into Ray's house, and then she came out of the shower, and he fell on top of her naked, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, she's gonna slap him in the face so hard. And then she was just like, would you please get off? And it was just so, the whole rest of the episode was just so supremely awkward.
Yeah. But I don't think I would have appreciated it as much. Like, me watching it, I only watched Evangelion last year, like, in totality, as opposed to just bits and pieces. I watched it from start to finish and watched Death and Life, or whichever.
Death and Rebirth, and then
End of Evangelion, and then Rebuild.
I can't remember. I just watched whatever was on Netflix, which is, I think, pretty much all of them.
I mean, the whole series is there, and then
I think it is. In any case, like with Evangelion, and my focus is on Gundam just because there's so much Gundam. Like, there's so much Gundam.
Oh, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of episodes of Gundam.
There's so much Gundam. And I didn't appreciate, and I didn't understand it. Like, okay, like, there is more going on underneath the surface. And I think I appreciate it more now than I would have if I had watched it as a kid. And like I said, like, sort of the impetus for me sort of going down this route was because I was playing a tabletop RPG. And I probably wouldn't be like dressing up and not that I could dress up as Gundam. I probably could, but if I want, side note, complete side note, but I probably wouldn't be like, oh my god, Gundam is everything. But I'm like, oh, this is actually pretty damn decent.
Also, let's be honest, at our respective ages, no one media product can be everything anymore.
No.
Yes, that is also, that is absolutely true. But I literally, like yesterday, I was watching like the sequel to Seed. I was watching Seed Destiny. I'm probably like episode 15 or 16. And like old characters from the first series came up. And I'm like, I literally did a fist pump. Like, yes, these guys, they're back. They're back, baby. I don't know. Yeah.
This calling like, stuff is fun.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Like, it's got all the kiddie, you know, it's got all the tropes of anime that I like and enjoy anyway. But it's got with that some of the other stuff. So there's more to it than just giant robots and big explosions. But it's not as dark and grim as Evangelion is, because that's just like, I don't think I could watch that over and over again.
Except, and I will stand by this, I kind of actually hate End of Evangelion, because that movie is just a depression. Like, it is just so dark. It's just the orgy of depression. The TV ending, I actually freaking love, and I think it's super uplifting. It's just the expectations going in for any kind of production value.
Oh, yeah. I think I've got all of them. Like, I've got the entire Platinum box set. I've got the two film collection, and I've got the rebuild stuff. And it really, like, it's such different vibes depending on which one you're watching. Ken, do you think... Do you have, like, a different feeling? And, Tim, you could probably comment on this as well. Like, I feel like there's something... I don't know if I can even put a label on it, but there's something kind of cool about finding new hobbies at an age where generally, I think, I know my parents, especially before me, were pretty much locked in. Like, they weren't doing new things, or they were pretty much just, they did the things they did and that was it.
I think, I mean, there is part, that's, I think so, because I literally had this conversation with my mum several years ago. Like, she came to visit me. My parents live in Singapore, and she came over to visit me. And it was one of those times where she was actually staying with us for quite a long time. She was going to stay with us for like two or three months. And she's staying at home, and I'm going out to work. And, you know, my wife and I, we've got our own schedules, and we come home and we pick up our kids from childcare. And I was genuinely worried about my mum being on her own during the workday when I wasn't here. So I said to her, Mum, like, look, we're not going to be here during the workday. We're not going to be here. Like, Grayson's, my son's at childcare. You're going to be home alone. Is there anything that you would like to do or you would like to explore whilst they're here? Like, is there anything you would like to do, like hobbies that could occupy your time whilst we're away from home? And apparently, my mom came to me like 3 or 4 days after that, and she spoke and she said, like, my one question had kept her up all night, because, like, she couldn't think of what she actually liked to do for herself.
Huh.
Other than, you know, because her whole life been, her whole, most of her life has been caring for us and caring, because, you know, in Singapore, we live with our parents. Like, that's the norm. You live with your parents until you get married, and then you move out. Or, actually, equally common is you move back into the home and back together with your parents. Like, moving away from home is weird. Right? So, a lot of her time over her life has been spent looking after us, caring for the family, that sort of thing. And, so I'm asking her, what does she want to do? What does she actually want to do? And she was like, I don't know. And, like, I'm thinking about my current situation here. like just now I talked about board games and about possibility space. I think I feel like us being where we are right now in the time that we are, we actually have a lot of that possibility space. Like there are new hobbies, there are new things to learn about. Like they have new bits of information. I think my mom's far more happier now because like she is just like taken to the internet like crazy, and she's trying out, like she's just trying out all these things. But these were not ideas that she would have been familiar with up until recently. These wouldn't have been processes that she would have been familiar with. But here it's like coming into archery a little bit. It was a whim on a Christmas New Year holiday a couple years back. I'm like, let's give it a shot. Sounds like fun. Is there an archery range near me? And I went on Google and it's like, oh, there's actually two. And I went to one. And it's like, oh, this is kind of fun. I'll come back again. Huh, I actually really enjoy this. Let's do it again. And this is like the way it's been with RPGs and board games and anime and Gundam and archery. And it's like finding things to try. And I legitimately a couple months ago during just before this whole lockdown happened, I was like, oh, I would actually kind of like to go and learn some pottery, like just to do pottery because that sounds like fun. And my wife is also like, huh, maybe I want to go and learn and do some carpentry.
Like, yeah. You guys are going to, like, excel as a retired old couple.
I legitimately, like, a couple, and again, like, I was doing some cooking at home recently. I'm like, it'd be really fun to learn butchery.
Oh, wow, that's, like, hardcore. I mean, right. Over the course of COVID, since I've been working at home, my girlfriend's gotten more and more enthusiastic about trying to cook different things.
Yeah, but it's kind of like...
But butchery, that's a whole other level.
No, because I was having a lot of fun, like, deboning something. Like, because it's cheaper to buy. Like, we were also trying to find ways to save money. It's easier to buy meat on bone than deboned.
Yeah.
And I could just debone it myself. I'm like, oh... This is kind of interesting. I legitimately went looking for like deboning knives online.
Cool, I guess. That's a weird note to end on, but we're running pretty long, so I guess.
Yeah. No. So, like, I guess, like, in summary, it's like Steve's question. It's like, yeah, I think that there is far more opportunity, like now, like. For us in the position we're in. Yeah,
it's kind of weird. I mean, I spent most of my 30s just going deeper and deeper down a craft beer hole. and that scene, like 20 years ago, just didn't exist.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only could you go down a craft beer hole, you craft beer, craft whiskey, craft gin, craft whatever. Like,
yeah, I'm not going to do that to my liver.
Well, yeah, I guess that, like, the internet, for all its faults, does facilitate you to really engage with particular hobbies much more, and more communities have sprung up around those things. I also wonder if it's like part of our age and where we are now as well, like in terms of, I think in your teens and early 20s, generally hobbies are to straight up waste time because you've got so much time and nothing to fill it with, or it is in service of a career or something else like that. And we're probably all at a stage where we're pretty secure in what we do as a job, so anything you're doing outside of that is literally just for pleasure. You don't have time to waste anymore, so what time you do have, you want to spend doing things you honestly really enjoy.
So while you were absent, Steve, I was pretty much like picking up the idea of like buying a separate digital to analog converter for your PC, whatever, and I think part of what facilitates something like that is the fact that music is nowhere near as expensive anymore, so the money you save.
Yeah.
Shit, when I was a kid, like a new CD was like $25 to $30.
Oh yeah, God.
And that's like 12 to 14 songs, and the money you save on that very quickly can go towards like getting some gear to like appreciate the stuff that is now way more accessible.
I mean, on that very note, how much money have you made so far selling all your shit, Steve?
About $2,000 in 6 weeks I've made selling stuff that I had sitting around. So $700.
Do you want us to link an eBay link or something in the show notes?
I've got nothing up at the moment. $700 on two Bloodborne guidebooks that were still sealed in shrink. $500 on Yu-Gi-Oh cards that have been sitting in my cupboard for 20 years. Nearly $500 on Dragon Ball Z Tarzos that had been sitting in my cupboard
for
a couple of years. A couple of other odds and ends that I'd put up there that have gone for a bit of money. It's very weird considering, like, you know, this was all stuff that I'd said. I was like, oh, I can't really be bothered. It's probably not worth anything anyway. And then, you know, my wife sort of harassing
me. You are the confused mum who, like, found the box underneath the kid's bed and then somehow made a mint off of it.
Oh, yeah. It's stuff that I've just been dragging around with me for literally 20 years. And
so you've
every time
eventually
I move,
paid off.
Yeah, every time I move, it gets tossed in another box. And then every so often I'm like, oh, I should just throw that stuff out. But, you know.
Or you know, sell it. Anyway, I'm going to force this thing to wrap up now because you're running over time. Steve, where can we find you? What have you been doing that isn't selling old stuff?
Literally bugger all. My output has been pretty shameful recently. I'm just flat chat at between work and kids, so I'm hoping I can remedy that shortly.
Well,
but
you are on this podcast.
On this podcast, obviously, and I am sometimes doing things at player2.net.au.
Cool. Ken, what about you?
Yeah, I mean,
you're good at pimping. You're really good at pimping. You do your pimping thing.
Oh, I mean, if I had stuff to pimp,
spruking.
Same as Steve, my output has just been dropped down to nil. I haven't even played anything other than 5 minutes of a shitty game and the same game for the last 4 weeks. So, I'm at Pixel Hunt on Twitter. It's output's low right now, but always check out the Player 2 YouTube channel, which is full of stuff. I don't know how Paul does it. It's just ridiculous.
Just there's a certain percentage of the population that doesn't need anywhere near as much sleep. Who knows? I'm at Pretend Beard on the Twitters, and I definitely need more sleep. I'm just gonna throw that one out there.
I'm getting plenty of sleep. It's just like